The World Tomorrow. Garner Ted Armstrong brings you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Millions of human beings around the world are boycotting government these days. In the United States, there are additional millions who simply give those candidates for national office a no vote, rather than get involved in politics one way or the other. As a matter of fact, from nation to nation around the world, government has been in crisis for quite a period of time now, with scandals, political fragmentation, economic headaches, various problems of one sort or another, usually at the very top level involving kickbacks, graft, bribery, underhanded machinations of government officials, convincing the populaces of much of the world that practically everybody in government, of practically every country, from Japan to West Germany to England to the United States to you name it, is guilty of some kind of corruption. And likely, much of the time, those same people are quite correct in their assumptions. As a matter of fact, it was revealed recently in a survey that about 10 million dropouts are going to join the already non-voters' ranks of millions, so that perhaps the turnout in the November elections in the United States will be well below half of the total eligible voters in the country. It seems that a lot of these same people really desire to see leadership, to see a strong hand at the helm of government. That was an observation by Hans J. Morgenthau not long ago, professor, very renowned one of political science, who has written a book on politics among nations. He said the nation state is now too small an entity to protect the life, liberty, and happiness of its own citizens. Western democracy, he said, faces a crisis of democracy. That is, Western Europe does. Many liberal Democrats are asking themselves whether old and proven democratic institutions are resilient enough to respond to the challenges of the times, or whether benumbed citizens may turn to demagogues for easy answers to complex problems that have been bedeviling them. He thought that perhaps the average grassroots individual, the man in the street, just can't see very much about some of the most important issues like inflation and energy and the like. He doesn't understand those problems. He looks more at the food on his plate, the shirt on his back, the gas in his tank, the vacation coming up next month, the camper, the truck, the trailer, the boat, the vacation, the recreational opportunities, fringe benefits, insurance, overtime. He looks at all of these various day-to-day problems on a checkbook day-to-day basis rather than the big national problems, which he can't really understand, and so not being able to understand those problems, he can't understand why his leaders can't solve those problems. He can't see why they should be so difficult. The complexity of problems, however, on the world scene at large demands complex solutions sometimes and a degree of international cooperation which is now waning as never before. So whether you look around the world at the toppling of governments of the last several years, when the governments of the United States, Britain, Canada, West Germany, Japan, and all the other great powers, for that matter, have one after the other toppled, either through death, assassination, some coup of one type or another, or some political upheaval, usually resulting from scandals, as in the case of the United States, Japan, Britain, and other countries. There have been very few governments that have survived the incredible worldwide domino effect of the toppling of governments of the past 5 or 6 years. At the very same time, we see a bewildering array of problems buffeting the world's industrialized democracy. And to everyone's dismay, those problems of runaway inflation, of joblessness, of balance of payments deficits, of crime, pollution, urban crises, racism and riots, growing anarchy, assassinations, hijackings, and the like, seem to defy solutions in country after country around the world. One of the real curses of today's civilization is the incredible pace with which things seem to change. It's the sheer velocity of the problems that overtake national leaders. So that instead of having the kind of leadership which can be unfettered from the problem-solving day-to-day crisis meeting level, to deal instead with the far-reaching and profound creative activities of true leadership, which should be visionary, which should be at least idealistic enough to pursue meaningful goals, which should be devoted to purposes and programs that far would outlive present generations, most new leaders in government find themselves immediately enmeshed in an absolute inextricable morass of blinding and mind-boggling problems for which there are no single solutions. I think if we, the people, could understand how we, the people, are so completely self-contradictory, how we demand the impossible of our leaders, we could understand how the leaders are doing fancy foot races and cute little minuets, pirouettes, and dance steps all around the general public, whether on the issues of abortion or any other you would like to mention, in order to try to please the general electorate. Because the name of the game seems to be get in, win, and then worry about the problem. Any presidential candidate who says he will do thus and such is, of course, sticking his neck out about 10 miles, and he will only do so because he thinks he is forced to do so when he is unable any further to do fancy little pirouettes around the issues. I think we all hear the stories going around about expediency, about being mealy-mouthed and speaking out of both sides of your mouth at the same time, about taking pro and con stands on each issue, about trying to please everybody. But on the other hand, look at the confused electorate. Americans want a powerful, strong America, second to none. They are bedeviled now by the idea that the Soviets may have achieved not just nuclear parity, but nuclear strategic superiority, and they want the United States to remain powerful and strong. On the other hand, many Americans want the United States to cut defense budgets. So it's difficult for a presidential candidate to promise both. The two are simply inharmonious, incompatible. On the one hand, the voters want far more jobs. On the other hand, they don't want big government. So on the one hand, why they demand government programs, projects, government funding and spending, especially, of course, dumping more billions into defense and arms industries to provide those jobs, so that the people can have the money in circulation, the government can print the fake money that we still have confidence in. As long as the confidence game continues, of course, the money is good. When the confidence runs out, the money runs out with it. And that, too, is inharmonious and contradictory. You can't have both. We want, on the one hand, far more federal-funded programs, such as Medicare and Medicaid, welfare, guaranteed minimum wages. We want protection from any kind of economic disaster. If we lose a job, we want to go on making as much or more money, regardless, being paid for non-working, even though we are physically able to work. And we don't want graft, greed, corruption, avarice, and cunning to be associated with the administrators of these federal projects. But you put a federal administrator, a state, local, or county official, within easy reach of the cash box, who is there administering a budget where his own trips, fringe benefits, favored employees, his own personal pet projects are all inextricably enmeshed within that budget, and you might as well put a hungry mouse in a cage right alongside a slab of Swiss cheese. You're not going to be able to deal with the problem of human nature, which basically is vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, cunning, avarice, a desire to get, to grab, to take for itself, and to have all these federal programs absolutely free of avarice, cunning, and greed. So we pretend to be outraged every single time we pick up a newspaper and find somebody at some level or another of officialdom, whether a policeman on the beat, a judge behind the bench, or someone in the Capitol in Washington is guilty of some sort of thirst or craving for material benefits. And some of it can be so absolutely petty. Witness the press attacks upon various heads of respected institutions in the United States, such as the FBI, as well as state and local police departments and the like. So the general public is completely turned off because they believe, that is, about 61% of them think, that quite a few of the persons running the government are at least a little crooked. That's because we appraise ourselves that way, too. It's because the average person knows he is a little bit crooked, and he suspects that his neighbor is probably about the same way. It's a little ridiculous, though, the electorate to expect the government to deal with the problems of graft, of crime, of the corporation ripoff, of closing all the tax loopholes, while he, John Q. Public, probably wants to take advantage of those same tax loopholes. It's a little ridiculous for him to assume
that we can have far more government-funded programs such as welfare, Medicaid, and the like, and yet have smaller governments. The electorate demands smaller government, less bureaucracy. Too many people on the government payroll, they say. Government is too big, they say. Let's make it smaller. And at the same time, they demand dozens of additional government projects, programs, and various benefits coming their way. No presidential candidate can promise realistically the voters both of those things at either extreme of the poll. And then we turn around and blame the man for sounding mealy-mouthed and somewhat like a hypocrite. I don't know whether we will ever, in this modern era, live to see a time where a candidate for public office would be a man of absolute inviolable principles, a man of certain deep convictions, and he would be absolutely unshakable on those convictions and those ideals, and he would very clearly be able to articulate those ideals to the American people. And on those ideals and principles, he would stand, no matter what it cost him. Whether it cost him an election, a career, all the money he's got, that he were a man of such absolute powerful convictions and principles that no matter what the consequences, he would never forsake those principles. It reminds me a little bit of the difference between the Australian automobile dealers and the United States automobile dealers. At least it used to be this way. Years ago when I went to Australia, I discovered with a gasp of amazement that you can, say, be looking at a Holden. Now that's an Australian production automobile. You can go to one dealer and you walk in, there on the rack is a spec sheet. You pick it up, it says that a Holden station wagon costs thus and such. It lists all the extras, and that doesn't in Australia mean steering wheel, tires, engines, pistons, seats, and interior. It does maybe mean a side mirror, or maybe it means air conditioning or something like that. But at any rate, it is a price list. And each one of those items were priced. They were itemized. Your, you know, two-speed windshield wipers cost you X, and so on. Then you could add them all up, and you would find out what a 19-whatever new Holden cost you. You then go to another part of the same city, and you walk into a dealer. And as you walk into the dealer, you pick up the spec sheet on a Holden, and you look, and lo and behold, it's the same spec sheet. And the prices are identical. Now, of course, there would be differentials in the amount of money you were allowed, perhaps, on a trade-in, because that might have to do with the condition of the automobile, the number of miles you've driven it, and so on. But this was a straightforward, in my opinion, way to buy an automobile. There were no surprises. Nobody was dealing with either a sharp or a dull pencil. Nobody was giving you all the gimmick and the hullabaloo and the rush about the little old lady from Pasadena with sneakers on that never drove the thing except on Sundays around the block. And the rest of the time it was in the garage on blocks and had exactly 11 original miles on it. No one was telling you all this stuff. You didn't suspect that there were tool marks around the back of the speedometer where someone had cranked the cable back a few thousand miles. You were given a straightforward spec sheet about exactly what the automobile cost, and you could make a choice as whether you wanted to afford one. But in the United States, we don't do it that way in our system, because you will go to one dealer who is a new automobile dealer, and he will say, now I can get you into that car for thus and such. And he's willing to go 7 years at 12, 13, 14%, whatever it is, give you a balloon deferred payment at the end, tell you you'll never have to pay it. The point is, he'll get you into the car, probably for $11.37 per month if he can't let you pay interest for the first 17 years. Now, of course, I'm kidding a little bit. But it is a little bit different. On the one hand, you are told from the word go, look, I want to get you into that car. They could just stop the word get you, but they don't. You want to see yourself in that car, and so the language is, I want to put you in that car. You're going to be in that car. We're going to figure a way. I remember one time I had an automobile I'd been paying on for a long time. I had traded in a 46 convertible. That's going back to the dealing age a little bit there, but I had owned that lock, stock, barrel, nuts, bolts, and top, and muffler, and I'd traded it in on a newer used car, you know, a 1952 model. I'd been paying on that quite a while. I drove into a new car dealer, and I was going to see what I could be given on trade to buy a new automobile. and he told me I owed him money. I drove my car into his garage and I was suddenly in debt. You know why? Because the payments, the payoff on that used car I had been working on for years actually was higher than the amount of equity I had. In other words, I had zero equity. I was still in a hole. I hadn't even paid down long enough yet to pay off the indebtedness it would take him to incur by taking in the old car. I couldn't believe it. It was my car. My name was on the registration. It was mine as long as I made the payments, and they were only about 52 and a half or so a month. And he told me I owed him money. Well, that's the way it is. Sometimes you owe more on things than they're worth, don't you? That's what happened to me, at any rate. Well, I like to think about the difference in government as, by that analogy, that instead of finding a man who has that spec sheet, he is such and such an age, he is of such and such a conviction, and he has such and such a record. His life is a wide open book. You can read exactly what he stands for, how he has voted, what he says, and he never does mealy-mouthed. He always speaks out of the same side of his mouth. As the story goes around about one presidential candidate whose daddy called him in off the farm one day and said, "Son, did you or did you not chop down the cherry tree?" And he said, "Father, I cannot tell a lie. Either I did, or I didn't." Well, I think you've heard that one circulated around enough. It's probably been repeated plenty of times. But, you know, neither one of the presidential candidates is stirring all that much wild enthusiasm among the non-voters today. As a matter of fact, when asked to name the political figure in their own lifetimes, all these dropouts and non-voters in the United States now, whom they most admired, only 1% of them mentioned either of the 1976 presidential nominees. They cited most John F. Kennedy or Franklin D. Roosevelt. And after that, several others, all of them, of course, are dead. So preliminary findings on a study of non-voters proved what is pretty largely understood in populaces around the world, and most especially as we approach the elections in the United States of America, that the voting public is becoming more and more a non-voting, turned-off, disinterested public who really doesn't even see the need to go to the polls in the first place. That survey was conducted, by the way, by the Peter D. Hart Research Associates of Washington, D.C., under the sponsorship of the University of Denver and the Bipartisan Committee for the Study of the American Electorate, a committee to study voting curves and trends in the American electorate. They proved that while many people do really want strong leadership, they don't believe that either one of the presidential candidates are going to really solve that thirst for leadership. And it seems that American people in increasing numbers are giving negative shrugs of either disinterest or outright no to various of our leading institutions. The sponsors of that survey did not predict the number of people who would vote, but they did indicate that it would be a very low turnout, and they figured it would probably be below 70 million out of more than 200 million population, of which, of course, nowhere near that number are eligible to vote, but at least it is some kind of a commentary about the number of people who will. 63% of those interviewed said they trusted the government to do what is right only some of the time, or none of the time, by the way. 61% claimed they thought practically everybody in government was a little crooked. 63% thought the government of Washington was run by a few big interests. Oh, almost 70% said the candidates say one thing and do another, which means they actually accuse them of being totally dishonest. Others, almost 60%, said it just doesn't seem to really make any difference who is elected because there's no need to worry. Nothing's going to work out right anyway. I mean, they just figure it doesn't really matter who gets into Washington. Everything's still going to be all fouled up. All candidates seem to be pretty much the same. Half of them felt these dropouts. So an estimated 70 million Americans of voting age are going to boycott the presidential election, perhaps including about 10 million more who once might have voted regularly but now have simply dropped out of the political procedure because they just are disinterested in it, just turned off by it. I think Professor Hans Morgenthau's prophecy about the nation state now too small an entity to protect life, liberty, and happiness of citizens and people tending in nation after nation around the world to leap into the arms of some despot or some demagogue may be far closer to the truth than we like to think. And we need to fear that that could ever happen in the United States of America. Really, it is not a good commentary on American political life that millions are dropping out of the political process. It is not a good commentary for the sake of the preservation of freedom, of liberty, of the free enterprise system, to see, first of all, the virtual, as many people would say, disintegration of the two-party system, and to see the very deep divisions in both of the major parties, notably that of the Republican Party, and of course the attempt to heal that wound, which was a very large gap at the time of the Republican convention, and which could have been even larger had it denied, perhaps, the nomination to its incumbent president. But many have speculated that the Republican Party in its present configuration is virtually dead. I don't believe that is true, and I think that the present trend of circumstances is proving that it isn't true, but it is not good news, nevertheless, to see that up to 70 million Americans are boycotting a national election. I don't think that the interests of the country are served in that. It would be far better if you and I could both know that 100% of the electorate went to the polls, and that the choice which was made was a choice not by default, but an actual choice representing the majority of the American public. I think we would all be better off, and of course each candidate, win or lose, would be better off. There could never be anyone holding his head and saying, if only more people who were able to vote and probably would have voted for me had gone to the polls, I would have won the election. So many people believe among these non-voters that what we need most, that is more than laws and political programs, would be leaders of impeccable credentials, strong, courageous, powerful leaders in whom the people can put their faith, in whom the people can place their trust, and behind whom the people can rally, and which would inspire their enthusiasm. But they don't have that kind of inspiration today. This is what they really are saying. Really, it is no different from what people around the world are saying about their leaders, or of their leaders, or a wistful desire for new leaders. They would like to see leaders of strong conviction, of great courage, of vision, of inspiration, men of honesty, men of deep conviction, men who would inspire loyalty, dedication, zeal, enthusiasm, men in whom they could place their trust and their faith. Failing this, of course, they simply become turned off, and it's as much a commentary on the mood of the country as perhaps any other thing that has been revealed lately. Meanwhile, around the world, world governments are in trouble. There's a new big Donnybrook building at the United Nations building. According to the capitals of the world, from where you hear about the war in Lebanon, guerrilla attacks in Rhodesia, race riots in Southern Africa, arms talks with Russia, and all of the problems in the Middle East, the incredible toppling of governments around the world, now we look like we're slated for a knockdown, drag-out fight in the United Nations because of a portent of trouble to come from a political declaration issued at the non-aligned summit in Colombo, Sri Lanka. In the non-aligned third world nations who've met down there, which included, of course, such nations as India, Egypt, and many others in Central and South America, Asia, and the like, on issue after issue, what really occurred down in Sri Lanka was an utter condemnation of the policies of the United States of America. Now, of course, you would think that wouldn't worry Washington, but it does. And the reason it does, out of the 86 countries down there at Colombo in the non-aligned conference, 82 of them are United Nations members. And they are backed by Russia, China, and other communist governments. And they happen to have more than enough votes to get through any anti-American resolution they would choose in the General Assembly. And we know that. Now, I long since dismissed, as far as I'm concerned, as one citizen, the United Nations. That's where I totally disagree with President Gerald Ford on what he said about the laudatory achievements of the United Nations. I think the United Nations is a hollow, empty shell. I think it is a laugh. I think it's a shame. I think it's an absolute stigma and a blight. I think the United States should not be supporting it, should not even be a member of it. I don't believe that all of those dozens of nations should be invited to the United States, to our own shores, to enjoy the kind of lodgings, food, limousines, and accommodations they get in New York City, to be chauffeur-driven back and forth to their chambers in the big building hovering over the East River there, which I think should have a great big R.I.P. on the top of it, meaning rest in peace. It looks like a gravestone anyway. I call it the non-united, disunited, ununited non-nations. It has admitted into its General Assembly a so-called freedom fighter waving his arm and revealing, as he lifts his jacket, a pistol, who has now been accepted, by the way, even in the Arab League, I understand, as an organization of Arab states, as a bona fide member
even though the PLO is not a nation, does not have any government as such. The various splinter guerrilla groups who war against women and helpless babies and who hijack aircraft and terrorize innocent victims and murder, kill, bludgeon, strangle, bomb, stab, and shoot people. But as long as that hollow, empty sounding gong on the East River there in New York City remains, I suppose the United States has got to play the funny little game of listening to all of these weird types from around the world, such as guys like Muammar Gaddafi, who is an international financier of Arab terrorist organizations killing innocent victims, stand up and berate the United States on every conceivable program or project we have. So when we find that people are trying, because of political expediency, to say the United Nations has a great record, I say the opposite is true. The United Nations has neither prevented a war from getting started, nor has it stopped a war once it got started, nor has it been able to really arbitrate or negotiate between the participants in a war. I don't think Mr. Ford should have given the United Nations any credit for keeping the Arabs and the Israelis away from each other in the Sinai. I think he should have taken the credit himself. It was the United States of America, through Henry Kissinger's shuttle, in spite of the fact of what I might think about Dr. Kissinger's statements in Southern Africa recently, or towards Southern Africa, and the vote-getting implications of Dr. Kissinger's statements with regard to white minority governments in South Africa as it might spin off into the presidential campaign. I think it is nevertheless obvious that had the United States not involved itself in volunteering not all of its best offices of its own Secretary of State, and its own C-130 sales to Egypt, and its own open policy more toward Egypt and Sadat's visit here. Remember all the background and the output there. I was there twice in the spring. I remember I talked to Sadat himself. I talked to him personally. I don't think Gerald Ford should have given the United Nations any credit for the present little bit of a breathing spell in the Middle East. I think he should have taken the credit himself. It might have helped him a lot more. I think he deserves the credit, by the way. I think it's terrific that we have a little bit of a breather in the Middle East and those people aren't killing each other. But I think the reason is because the United States promised Egypt some military aid. And because the Egyptians had burnt their bridges with the Soviet Union, as we reported in the pages of the Plain Truth magazine. I think another reason is that neither the Israelis nor the Egyptians really on the grassroots level want to be killing each other. I think the reason is shuttle diplomacy and American guarantees. And I don't think the United Nations had one thing to do with it. I also have to mention that it is United States, not United Nations, United States civilians who volunteered to go man those listening posts to keep those people apart down there. Those two nations apart. No, I wish when the president spoke to the Air Force base the other day about the great achievements of the UN, he might have mentioned maybe UNESCO or something, sure. Maybe there have been some things they've done you could say were good or partly good. But as far as I'm concerned, the disunited non-nations is about as much a monument as was the League of Nations and the Treaty of Versailles. And when we wake up and recognize that it's already dead, we'll realize we ought to get about the business of wondering what the future is really going to hold. Well, I've got to break off the lack of time. I'll get in that subject and need another 2 hours. But if you'll write for the current number of the Plain Truth magazine, you can get articles on what's really going on in this rat race in this world and what's going to come out of it all. If you'll dial the toll-free number right now, 800-423-4444, and also request that booklet on how to understand prophecy. 800-423-4444. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow with Garner Ted Armstrong, sponsored by the Worldwide Church of God. For literature offered on this program, send your requests along with the call letters of this station to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Or you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444.